Hello, 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 hello.
You are listening to Running the Voodoo Down on BAM FM.
As a person obsessed with music, I've always been fascinated by new ways you can interact with it. As a musician, maybe this is a new scale or chord quality or tone you hadn't known of or heard before. As a listener, maybe it's a new band or genre that makes you dance or feel something you haven't felt before. Or maybe it's taking music with you in a boombox or on your iPhone, or Bjork's iPad app that's really an album. Or maybe it's an album that was really an iPad app. In any case, I believe there's always something to be learned from a new perspective. Today on Running the Voodoo Down, I have two guests that are changing the way we can interact with music. What I find unique is that they're both coming out of a generation raised on video games, and they're using that fluency to encourage musical exploration and education. We have an inventor of digital musical interfaces, whose do-it-yourself attitude led him to a whole new method of making electronic music. And we have a guitarist who, in his job as a note tracker for the Ubisoft game Rocksmith, is radically changing the way you can learn to play the guitar. I am Micah Dubroy, and this is Leveling Up. My first guest is Matt Moldover, who professionally simply goes by Moldover. He is known as the godfather of controllerism, which is a term that he can take credit for coining. It means that he manipulates and creates music using digital interfaces, which are called controllers. What's interesting about Moldover is that he builds his instruments himself, and it was hearing about other musicians using his pieces that introduced me to him in the first place. I asked him how he got into electronic music initially.
I didn't really get into electronic music until I went to college. I was pretty much an acoustic musician, playing rock and metal and pop in high school and starting bands. And I played a lot of video games, and I programmed computers and had that electronic side of me, but I hadn't been exposed to any electronic music that wasn't really generic dance music, and that wasn't my background. So it was in college where I got introduced to like Ninja Tune artists and Warp Records artists. This is like early 2000s, late 90s, and that was the stuff that turned me on to like, you can do all kinds of stuff with electronics.
Electronic music has been around in various forms since as early as the 1920s, when Soviet inventor Leon Theremin invented his eponymous instrument. This kind of direct engineering of circuitry and signal was synonymous with electronic music for a long time, until the digital revolution. It's this hands-on spirit that Moldover would eventually tap into.
I was trying to merge it with my interest in playing in bands, so I was a guitar player, so I got like a MIDI, pitch to MIDI system for my guitar and became like basically like the synth player for this live drum and bass band and a couple other bands. And that was kind of ill-fated because I wasn't that into drum and bass, and pitch to MIDI systems for stringed instruments are really not fun to play. So my instrument became this kind of like clunky, less fun kind of thing. So it was a kind of a rocky start.
And is that what inspired you to start making your own controllers?
I didn't get into that until later because I got turned on to Ableton really early, like 2001, 2002 when it first came out. And I had just done a little bit of remixing the tool called Sonic Foundry Acid, which lets you do really fast things with time stretching, with looping. And Ableton had those same features, but in a really real-time way, and it was designed for performance. It's called Ableton Live. A lot of people forget software is called Live. So it would let you do all those crazy things with time stretching that Acid did, but you could hook up a MIDI controller and have a knob that would instantly change the tempo of every single loop that's playing. And you could throw in, the coolest thing I thought was you could throw in entire songs, a sample of any length, and synchronize it to another song of any length. You had to drop markers into it if it wasn't recorded with a click track, but basically like first things I threw in there were Hey Joe by Jimi Hendrix and like the Amen break and just to be able to like press a button and have them synced up and then turn a knob and change it to whatever tempo. I was like, oh my god, this is the coolest thing ever. It wasn't even like I wanted to go out somewhere and play Hey Joe with a breakbeat on top of it, but basically I realized like that could merge the craft of of kind of what DJs do, this kind of like sample manipulation thing with live performance in a way that I just thought was mind-blowing to me. So it wasn't like that's where my passion lied, but it was like, this is such a powerful thing. I can't imagine this will not be a thing.
But he didn't see it take off the way he expected.
I really didn't, and that was like a source of much frustration, because I was doing it and I was having a tremendously good time, and then I would try to take that to a venue and, you know, people around me didn't really get what I was doing, because, you know, it sounded kind of like what DJs will do. Like, I'm playing popular music. I started playing even more popular mainstream music because that would help people connect with it, and they would hear it more when I manipulated it. But that was the trick, is like being able to do so many powerful and abstract things to a sound, you know, with something that at that time like looked like a keyboard with some extra faders and knobs on it. People just couldn't make the connection, you know, and I'd forgotten that like regular audiences, when they go to see a band or something, they might not even understand like which sound is coming from the guitar and which sound is coming from the keyboard. That takes actually a little bit of like committed thought and understanding and listening. You know, for most music fans, like, they get to that level of, like, they go to shows and they can figure that stuff out. But anyways, what I was doing was kind of ahead of this curve and so abstracted that people couldn't really appreciate that it's not just that I played a CD with a remix of Jimi Hendrix on it. It's like I'm creating that remix in real time and sort of improvising what happens to it and where it goes next and that kind of thing. So, no, I didn't see it happening around me, and that was kind of good because that led to me going further than I had before to try and communicate, and that was making videos and putting them on YouTube in the very early days of YouTube, which got me a lot of exposure, playing a lot more shows and doing less recording, because if you just hear the music, you know, it's less obvious than you go to a show or you watch a video and you see, you know, what's happening live. And then that kind of led to the whole controllerism of trying to create a movement, trying to create a community, just trying to create a word to better communicate there is something new happening here. This is not what you know. You should check this out. Controllerism has a Wikipedia definition that I didn't write, but it's using new technology, digital controllers and software to make music. I didn't define it. You know, when I initially sort of published the word, it was with a video, and I just said, I'm a controllerist. Here's what I do. Check it out. And I made some music. And I think that's the point, is that it's not, I try to keep it as broad and inclusive as possible, because it's, I'm trying to invite as many people to the party as possible.
Moldover takes this mission very seriously, though he hasn't always gotten the response from his peers you might expect.
It was pretty slow, I think. I mean, it was two groups of people who I think are drawn to this, and one is musicians, people who are trained to play musical instruments, and usually, you know, with a group of other musicians. And for them, I think it was still on this kind of lower rung of like, oh, that's not real music. If you're not triggering every single one of those sounds in real time, that's not a musical instrument, you know? That's DJing, you know, or whatever. And for DJs, I think it was like, man, you're doing all that work and all that preparation and all that like programming and learning like abstract, you know, marking what key the songs are in, you know, like this tremendous amount of work to produce like an hour of music, which, you know, they basically just playing CDs or vinyl or virtual vinyl or whatever, they just kind of improvise for 5 hours and do that, you know, and it sounds better if you just listen to the audio. So to them, it was, you know, to both of those groups of people, I think it was just this sort of like, why would you do that? why make it so hard?
It's probably a good time to step back and think about what it is that Moldover is actually making, how it's different from your standard drum machine or Moog style synthesizer.
Well, a big difference is I'm making controllers. So these are things that are really just interfaces and don't do anything without you connecting them to a computer, for one thing. So you know, something you call a synthesizer keyboard or whatever. It's usually a self-contained thing that is both the interface, the keyboard, but it's also the synthesizer, the things that make sound. Basically, yeah, I try to draw the best ideas from those traditional hardware designs. And what makes my things special for the most part, I think, is that I'm making like really ergonomic things, because I'm used to something like a guitar, which is so nice. You know, you strap it on, it kind of conforms to your body. It's all based on the shape of your hands and the way that they work. And so mostly I'm interested in making new electronic instruments that, you know, are their own expressive ergonomic instrument, like the Mojo, or integrate that into an existing one, like the Robocaster.
Now we can talk about Moldover's particular designs, which are the most exciting part of the story. The first we'll get into is the Mojo, which was intentionally designed to be dynamic and expressive, as he just said. Multi-instrumentalist, composer, and producer Jeff Countryman has called it the ultimate controllerist's controller, and it was Moldover's first commercially available piece.
That was at this point where my performances had begun to kind of take off. I was doing more gigs in this way, and there's an intermediary step where I started hacking up the things I could buy to make a more expressive instrument, a better instrument, and that thing started falling apart when I started traveling with it. So then I built my own instrument, the Mojo, the custom controller, and in the process I designed it so I could make more of them, because there were enough people who saw me play the prototype of the Mojo and were like, I want that thing, that is way cooler than what's in the stores. So I tried to set up my own little business and make them. And it turned out to be tons of work that I wasn't really interested in doing. So I did make and sell the initial run of 10, 11, and they're out there. But now my buddy Dave Cross, who runs a company called 60 Works, he'll make Mojos if you want more Mojo.
But it's the use of the Mojo that I'm most interested in. How is it expressive? How does it feel to play compared to a guitar or similar, more traditional instrument?
It feels pretty similar. I mean, the drive with the Mojo was really to create a controller that had some of the expressive possibilities of a traditional instrument. It's when I started writing my last album, which was released many years ago now, but basically I started bringing guitar into my performance, writing original music instead of doing those sample-based kind of collage mashup things. So I'm playing guitar again, and I'm playing this controller, and that's when it became most obvious, like, wow, this controller is not nearly as expressive as this guitar. You know, there's a lot of obvious reasons for that. They're not made to do the same things, but I felt compelled to like bring more expressivity to something like a controller. So the Mojo, I would say, does feel a lot like playing a guitar when I'm playing it. It's even like the way I use my right hand versus my left hand, like, you know, it's based on the articulation and the modulation, the same thing your right and your left hand do on the guitar. So so it was studying guitar and studying turntablism, and then also I think playing video games. People underestimate that, but when I go back and I play like Track and Field at the arcade or something, man, my stamina and dexterity is is kind of unmatched. But seriously, like, there is a parallel between the hand-eye coordination and the dexterity you develop playing games and playing music. And I don't really play games anymore, but half the parts in that thing came from, you know, your Track and Field, your Pac-Man or whatever. So there's crossover there.
It's this crossover that brings us to our next guest. As I mentioned before, this generational fluency in video games is having an interesting impact on culture. The video game industry earned $67 billion globally in the last year alone, and is continuing to grow rapidly. And what this means, in addition to a lot of people playing a lot of video games, is that the tropes of these games, whether they're narratives or interactive logics or simply terminology or timing, they're showing up in other mediums. In the last couple years, there have been a number of blockbuster movies, including Edge of Tomorrow with Tom Cruise and Source Code with Jake Gyllenhaal, that focus on the attempt, failure, death, and retry repetitional motifs that make up the multiple lives of video game avatars. Yeah, Groundhog Day already covered some of that ground, but this feels different. And last year's Gravity, which was stellar, by the way, and please excuse the pun, really felt like watching an incredibly beautiful first-person disaster escape video game, if there is such a thing. And then there's Rocksmith, which is a game produced by industry giant Ubisoft. It actually allows you to plug a real guitar or bass into your computer or game console, and then proceeds to actually teach you how to play the instrument. So when we come back, we'll be talking to someone who is involved in making this happen. Stay tuned.
You liking Running the Voodoo Down? Yeah, me too. We got many other podcasts too that you can check out at bam.tv. And probably the best place to go right now is Facebook. So everyone knows how to get to Facebook. And then you just type in BAMM.TV and you'll see our page and you'll get all the updates from all of our shows and check out all the videos and concert updates. Pretty dang good resource. All right, that's enough of me. Let's get back to the show.
I'm Micah Dubroy, and this is Running the Voodoo Down. My next guest has one of the coolest day jobs I've ever seen.
My name is Anthony Martinez, and I am a musician and employee at Ubisoft. I'm part of the Rocksmith development team.
And this is the direct intersection of music and video games that I've been talking about.
Rocksmith is educational software that teaches people how to play bass and guitar.
Not only that, but they have a very specific goal.
Rocksmith 2014 is the fastest way to learn how to play the guitar.
So how do they do this? Well, you take your guitar or bass and plug it into the game. From there, you have a couple of options. Either practice modes that double as mini games, open jam sessions where a virtual band actually follows your playing, or their flagship song learning mode, where you pick a tune from their library and the game will teach you how to play it from scratch. The way this works is there are graphics on the screen that correspond to strings and notes and frets, and as the song plays, it directs you how to play the parts and adjust the difficulty based on your performance, which is key. It can tell when you're doing well.
So detection is pretty good.
And it's able to analyze multiple levels of the performance.
Rhythmically, harmonically, it's accurate.
So if you can't master that tricky chorus the first time around, it will simplify it until you can, and then gently push you from there. How it does this is where Anthony's job comes in. You see, he's a note tracker. His job is to transcribe the songs into the game and then create digestible sections that they call phrases.
So we'll break a song into verses and choruses and create little phrases that the player can focus on.
And if that's not enough,
they have the option of going into this tool called Riff Repeater, which allows players to dive into each section of the song.
And again, each phrase is broken up into a number of difficulty levels that are designed to accommodate and encourage players.
We try to introduce one concept at a time, and it's usually one note on one string per level. If it's a matter of leveling a chord progression, we'll focus on introducing the root notes first, and then we'll eventually stack the notes so that the player can learn different hand shapes one step at a time until they're actually playing the entire chord. And then we get into strumming, we'll throw in different rhythmic figures and try to lead the player to the top level where they're actually playing what was recorded.
And this can take many different forms, depending on the source material.
A solo phrase could have as many as 30 levels to it, depending on how many techniques are involved. A simple riff or, you know, maybe a three-note power chord progression in a song like Blitzkrieg Bop. In fact, I think they use two-note power chords. But anyway, a song like that won't require as many levels because the content is simpler than something like a Slayer solo. Every song is unique in that way.
What impressed me most was the commitment to getting it right.
You know, all of the note trackers do a ton of research. We look at live performances, listen to different recorded versions, and compare those to what was actually recorded, so the master recording. And we decide on what the best representation will be for the game and what will allow people to learn. You know, we want everything to be authentic from the band's perspective. You know, we want people to not only learn how to play the song, but learn how to play like the artists played during the recording. There were songs that I thought I knew, you know, like the back of my hand, but the thing with guitar and bass especially is that you can play the same thing in so many different ways up and down the neck.
Do you have a favorite song you've worked on?
That is a good question. I really enjoyed working on Radiohead's Paranoid Android. The song is just beautifully crazy. There's so much going on harmonically, melodically, and it's always fun to play, just because it's so busy. And I also had the freedom to come up with different vocal arrangements for guitar and bass during the bridge when Thom Yorke is singing and, you know, he's playing guitar in the background. And it's just his voice and the acoustic guitar. And so I came up with vocal arrangements for bass and guitar to, you know, to play along with the vocals and sort of fill the space. So you actually get to play what he sings during that slow portion of the bridge. First and foremost, it is a game, but through playing it, you get to learn how to play an instrument. So it's really interesting how those two things intersect, you know, learning music and playing a game. We've offered 30 and 60 day challenges to people everywhere, and there's a ton of video footage of people who have never played before or tried at one point and got discouraged and ended up stopping, who just decided to play the game and learn how to play their instrument through Rocksmith. And, you know, by day 60, they were able to play most of the content on disc very fluently. And it's just, it's amazing, you know. I wish I had that guidance when I was first learning how to play the instrument, because I was all over the map.
And many of us were or might still be. Knowing how to practice correctly is maybe the most important information a musician can have. And the combination of not knowing what to do, not knowing how to measure your growth, and the fact that sometimes important exercises can seem tedious is what makes practicing so daunting for so many people. And it's what makes this game so intriguing. It's not that this should replace all existing models of learning music, teachers, peers, friends, but that it offers a method for solo practicing that might keep people engaged long enough to become attached to their instrument and to get excited about practicing. And it uses all the bells and whistles inherent in video games to motivate players.
I mean, the visual component is great. The colors are nice. And the sounds are fantastic. But there is a scoring system as well.
And we all know how effective points can be for motivation. Even just working on the game has been beneficial for Anthony.
Just producing note tracks has boosted my musicianship exponentially. Because every day is ear training. Yeah. You're constantly transcribing. You know, as a note tracker, you're learning how to play all of the guitar parts, the solos, you name it. And, you know, it encourages us to, maybe I should speak for myself, to slow down, you know, to learn everything one piece at a time, you know, just have fun with it. There's no need to rush the process. You know, learning takes time.
Do you think it can replace teachers at all? Or what role does it take in kind of that, the general learning ecosystem of teachers and other people?
Yeah, I wouldn't consider it a replacement. They're apples and oranges. I see benefits in private guitar instruction, you know, when you're sitting down with a person one-on-one. At the same time, I feel like sometimes musicians or students, I don't know, don't like the idea of practicing, or they'll see it in a negative way. You know, it's work. But I think Rocksmith makes it fun to practice.
Did you play video games growing up?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I feel like I just sort of jumped back into video games through this job.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I had taken a break for a while. But
did you have any favorites as a kid?
Super Mario World. SNES, I mean, I love that game.
I loved that game, too. I found it at just the right age for it really to have an impact on me. And perhaps not surprisingly, Rocksmith's method of learning can be really effective for kids. My favorite example is a little girl named Audrey.
Oh, yes. Her name's Audrey. She's from Japan, and she's actually posted a ton of videos of herself.
You can find them all over YouTube from the user Audrey123Talks.
And her younger sister usually joins her and is singing in the background, usually through a swimming pool noodle.
It's really adorable.
But it's amazing what Audrey's able to do.
She shreds. She really shreds.
She clearly just enjoys the game and has stuck with it and has, you know, noted her progress.
I imagine it's as inspiring to other kids as it is to adults.
yeah, it's just incredible to see that. And you know, watching that really makes me happy because, you know, I think that's what it's all about, just sharing music and seeing people learn and you know, achieve their goals.
I'm sure it's not a perfect tool, but Rocksmith seems really engaging and effective, and I'm really happy to see people working on ways to include a broader community in making music, and it's using a super popular modern medium and real old-fashioned instruments. And it's that combination that actually brings us back to Moldover, in just a moment. I'm Micah Dubroy, and you're listening to Running the Voodoo Down. Even though Moldover has had a career in developing controllers and the concept of controllerism, he also wants to focus on the guitar, his first instrument. And what about the Robocaster to get to that? You've taken a guitar and a controller and combined them. Can you talk a little bit about I can't assume the motivation is wanting to do both at once, but sort of what got you from step A to step B and how you feel working with it now?
It was a long path, but I had a moment similar to the one I described where I started playing guitar again and realized, oh, the controller's not that great. It was basically wanting to do more with the guitar, wanting to do more with the effects, you know, just something to kind of give myself a new voice, a unique voice, an original voice on guitar. That's something I think a lot of guitar players dream of, but there's so many of us, you know, so much territory has already been kind of claimed. It's like, what do you do? I used to play guitar without any control over the effects. Basically, I was just doing like a simple overdrive rock sound and like a clean rock sound, and I would do the whole show with basically two sounds and no foot pedals, no tap dancing. And I was like, I want to do some of that stuff. I want to be able to like crank it up and like kick in the delay and then play my solo and just kind of do that. And I decided a while before that like pedals aren't necessarily the best way to do that. You can't really see what you're doing with your feet. It keeps you tied to that specific spot on stage. You can't, you know, run out to the front and then kick in your distortion or whatever. So I was like, oh, put the controller on the guitar. So I went through a series of prototypes with that, and it turns out A, it's really fun, B, you know, it's still a guitar, and C, like, you can do incredibly expressive things with your hands that you can't do with your feet. And when you connect that with all the crazy software effects, because software, just so much is possible. So it, just with like the four buttons on the Robocaster, you know, what I came up with was like kind of doing what you do when you tap on guitar frets and you get different pitches. I just assigned different pitches to these four buttons on the Robocaster with a pitch shifter. And the cool thing about that is it feels and acts much like frets on your fretboard on your guitar, but it's pitch shifting the whole sound of the instrument, so you can shift chords. You know, it's super ergonomic, so you can play them really fast. And I was coming up with all these sounds that like I had never heard come out of a guitar before, and that was kind of the aha moment of like, oh yes, this is it. This is like, this can be my unique voice on guitar, is just this simple combination of an ergonomic controller built into the guitar where I can grab it with my hands and essentially do the improvisation and all the complex muscle memory kind of things that, you know, that musicians can do. Now I can do those with a pedal board. Like, screw the pedal board. I'll, you know, here's a better, well, one better or alternate way that you can play effects.
I just love the name Robocaster. I can't get over it. If I played guitar, I would want one immediately, not even knowing what it did. While I try to move past it, though, I want to pivot towards the other kind of work Moldover is doing, which is making electronic music more social. Again, this is a music that's mostly done alone, in front of a laptop or some kind of device, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's a beautiful thing to be able to make music by yourself, and I think it reflects how we now often listen to music, which is in the isolation of our own headphones. And yet, there's so much joy inherent in making music with other people, and Moldover's multiplayer instruments, called jamboxes, try to encourage that experience in controllerism and electronic music, though it's not always easy to pull off.
Yeah, well, so to me, they're two sort of very different kind of opposing categories of instruments. There's things like the mojo that I make for myself to perform, you know, so I want something that's got depth and complexity and expressiveness that, you know, other musicians or experienced controllerists would want. So the jam boxes, I've made really complicated pro jam boxes. I made one and I did some shows with it, and it's kind of a beast to take care of. But they have found much more acceptance as what I'd call casual instruments, which are just these simple things that anybody without musical training can play. So I've kind of, you know, kept those going in that direction and not tried to make, you know, the jam box for the Bjork tour or whatever. Like, I'm more interested in making jam box that will be at a children's museum or a festival or like in your coffee shop up the street or whatever. And they also give the social, you know, multiplayer thing that my own performances and my own instruments kind of don't really think about.
So do you still perform primarily solo?
Yeah, almost exclusively solo. I mean, I love having like guests. I love collaborating with people who do, you know, video or, you know, audio production, like creating things in collaboration. But in performance, running a band is so difficult. I don't know how people do it. I used to do it, and it drove me insane.
And I assume that when you made the sort of more complicated jam boxes for professionals, you would have to train them on how to use it. It wasn't like...
That was it. It's hard enough to build like and program a multiplayer controller, but then you're also trying to like form a band around it. That's one of the crazy things about musical training and bands and orchestras and all that stuff. It's like you work really hard on your thing and you want to do your thing, and it's hard to combine your thing with your thing and your thing and your thing and your thing all at the same time. So that was a challenge I was facing, and that was kind of too much on top of just the complexities of making a new kind of instrument.
Have you watched, ever had the experience of sort of watching people use it at a festival? And what do you see go through their faces and heads when they're suddenly being able to interact with this music for the first time?
I have taken them many places and watched many people play them. And it's pretty awesome. There's so many ways I could describe it. It doesn't turn everybody on. There's some people who are just kind of freaked out by like trying to make music with other people around, and that's understandable. Maybe they had like some bad, you know, 6-year-old piano lesson experience or something. But for a ton of people, once they realize that it's what it is and that it's really there and that they can really play it, they're kind of stoked on it, because they realize, oh, like this is what, you know, I've seen people do on stage. It's like a new kind of instrument. Like, you can play samples. It can do so many different things. But, you know, I can just play it right now. And hey, you can play it too. And it's already set up. So like, you've got the drums and I've got the bass and like, you've got the lead. It's pretty cool. I mean, so it's got that magical eye-opening, like turning people on and getting them inspired and excited. And then it's got the flip side of that, which is like, this isn't quite that simple. Like, I have to both enjoy and also kind of give in the form of listening, because none of these things are like automatic press play. They're just not that much fun if you do them like that. They all require you to like pay attention to what the person next to you is doing in order for you to actually like have an interaction, have a conversation, and make a complete piece of music. So, you know, it gives people, I think, both sides of what it means to make music with other people. I mean, but it does it quick and easy and painlessly and in a real visceral, tactile, and social kind of way. So, I mean, they're pretty awesome, pretty magical devices, and that's why I put a lot of time into them.
So what's next? Video games teaching music, giant multiplayer sonic contraptions, robot guitars. I asked Moldover what he thinks the future holds in store for us.
Lasers everywhere, on everything, all the time. And if that doesn't happen, the things I'm most excited about are ever smaller and more portable computing devices. So it's a short leap, you know, but like in my rig, like replacing a laptop with, you know, with a small battery-powered mobile device. Same thing with the jam box, you know, like there's a whole computer inside each of those jam boxes. It'd be cool if it was just a simple little device with a touchscreen. So that's one that people can obviously see, and it's not a big leap. But I think the more interesting one is these controllers, these peripherals, as technologies become cheaper and democratized, the instruments that are capable of really expressive things becoming affordable. So like back when I started getting into this whole thing, I was seeking out the best controllers. I ran into this block of like, oh, there's these like cheap things that are based on like, you know, a keyboard with some extra knobs, or like something that looks like a drum machine, you know, with some extra knobs. Or you can buy, you know, the $5,000 Hakan Continuum multi-touch surface, which is like an amazing freaking controller, but it's big, it's heavy, it's expensive, and it kind of only does one thing. It doesn't even have any knobs. But now there's things like that that have either come out really recently or about to come out, where they can capture all the nuances of what's possible with, you know, with their bodies, with their fingers, all the delicate kinds of expression that are voiced when you play something like a guitar or a violin or a keyboard. There's digital instruments that can do that, and these are things that are going to cost less than $1,000. And so, you know, somebody who's just learning music, you know, you can say, well, you can play the violin, or you can play this new multi-touch surface that you hook up to your iPad, you know, and, you know, that's a choice that I would love to have as a young person learning music for the first time, because I might be tempted to try the latter. And frankly, there's not going to be a better violin, and there's not going to be a better guitar. There's just going to be newer and more different instruments that will create different or newer possibilities. So there'll still be tons of people like picking up and playing these more traditional instruments, and I think that's great. And just the, you know, the plurality of everything. That and the lasers, yeah.
And that's our show, the first to feature lasers, but hopefully not the last. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, you can subscribe on iTunes, find and favorite us on Stitcher, which is an amazing podcast platform, by the way, or on SoundCloud. We've got a blog at rtvd.bamm.tv, that's Running the Voodoo Down at bam.tv, and a Twitter account with the handle @runthevoodoo. Please be in touch. This is a grand experiment, and we'd love to have you involved. I'd like to thank my guests, Moldover and Anthony Martinez of the Ubisoft game Rocksmith. You can find Moldover at moldover.com, and Rocksmith is at rocksmith.ubi.com. The music featured on the show today was by Moldover, Aerothyme, Andrew Lawbacker, Benjamin Andrews, Radiohead, and the Ramones. Our theme music is by Sioux City Kid. Thank you for listening. This has been Running the Voodoo Down on BAM FM.